Welcome to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Featuring stimulating in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Copeland.
Welcome to the show where we balance the intellectual with the creative, exploring whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. For the topic hour, I go out and about and talk to people on the street about a wide variety of different subjects that affect everybody, both locally and globally. And for this, the Arts Hour, I interview local, national and international guests from all areas of the arts. And I combine a discussion topic with an arts interview because I feel that debate and creativity are two of the most vital ways that we engage with the world. Well, this week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing award-winning director, writer and producer Mark Pellington. Mark's career represents a multimedia exploration in all narrative forms. Originally from Baltimore, Maryland, Mark received a BA in rhetoric and then joined MTV's award-winning on-air promotions department, where he created short conceptual spots, editing original footage with found sound and images. This groundbreaking work in collage and sound image text juxtaposition became the primary focus of his early work, leading to the creation of a 13-part global series, Buzz, with MTV Europe producer-director John Klein. While at MTV, Mark branched out as a freelance music video director and also ventured into the art world, collaborating on text-image pieces with New York gallery artist Jenny Holzer and William Burroughs. Mark became internationally recognized as one of the world's premier music video directors and has created videos for artists such as U2, Pearl Jam, Michael Jackson, Linkin Park, Foo Fighters, Bruce Springsteen, Nine Inch Nails, Alice in Chains, The Dave Matthews Band, Demi Lovato, Public Enemy, INXS, The Flaming Lips, The Fray, Jason Mraz, Cage the Elephant, Kid Rock, Moby, Natasha Bedingfield, De La Soul, Silver Sun Pickup, and Mia. He also co-directed U2's ambitious 3D concert film. And Mark has been honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award by the Music Video Producers Association. Outside of the music world, for television, Mark has created documentary and narrative films for PBS, including the five-part series, The United States of Poetry, and an impressionistic diary film, Father's Days, about his father suffering from Alzheimer's. His impressionistic adaptation of Don Snyder's novel of Time and Memory aired on the Independent Film Channel. He's also directed TV projects including Destination Anywhere, an experimental short film for MTV starring Demi Moore, Whoopi Goldberg, Jon Bon Jovi and Kevin Bacon, and directed James Earl Jones in an episode of the dramatic television series Homicide. He directed the pilot episode of CBS's Cold Case and served as a consulting producer, overseeing the visual look at the top-rated show for 4 years. He's also directed the pilots of CBS's Back and Anatomy of Violence, featuring Skeet Ulrich, ABC's Red Widow, NBC's Secret Lives of Husbands and Wives, and TNT's Cocaine Cowboys. Mark's latest TV success is Blindspot, an action thriller for NBC. Mark's feature films include Going All the Way, which debuted at Sundance and starred Jeremy Davis and Ben Affleck, the controversial political thriller Arlington Road, starring Jeff Bridges and Tim Robbins, the cult favourite The Mothman Prophecies, a cerebral paranormal thriller starring Richard Gere, Laura Linney, Alan Bates and Deborah Messing, and the controversial I Melt With You, starring Thomas Jane, Jeremy Piven, Rob Lowe and Christian McKay. Mark also creates art films, such as his work Honesty, and continues to direct music videos, commercial projects, TV series, and films. His latest feature film is The Last Word, starring Shirley MacLaine and Amanda Seyfried. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Nice to be here.
has had an amazing career. It's like I'm that was just the highlights. It was really hard to get it as short as that.
I'm exhausted. I was exhausted listening to it, but each one I have such fond memories. It's like a time capsule, and I remember where I was at every point in my life. It made me feel every day of my 55 years, I tell you that.
Well, I would say you've been using your time well, so definitely.
Well, thank you.
So you have this long background in the arts, embracing cutting-edge artistic values in all areas. I'm wondering if you can remember the first time you became aware of the power of art to affect us on a deep level as well as entertain us.
Well, I think it's very funny that the idea of the word balance, because that has actually been a very kind of driving force of my choices as an artist and as a man, really, in life, and balancing risky artistic endeavors with the work that maybe pays the bills to allow you to take more risks. I'd say early on in my career at MTV, making small promotional pieces, they would get on the air, and you would see them on the air on television, and you were the only audience. You didn't really know how they were affecting people until I think the New York Daily News or some local New York paper wrote something about one of the promos. Now, to get writing about a promotional spot is very rare. Mm. You know, people now write about commercials or movies and television all the time. But in the early 80s, remember, this was, you know, cable was just starting. There was no internet, no websites, no blog posts. So the exposure to your work was, very limited. It was really peer-based. And then I remember in the 1985, MTV was a hotbed of experimentation. So in the hallways, you literally would see Jean-Michel Basquiat or Andy Warhol or Keith Haring. These were the people doing art breaks for MTV, which were small 90-second, you know, basically little pieces where they had the creative control and our department produced them. So MTV at that time was considered very cutting edge as a showcase for music videos, and the art form of music videos at the time, as it started, was extremely new and respected as a new art form. Nobody had ever seen film and music like this before, even if we knew from the Beatles, Hard Day's Night, the merger of music and image. But the contained kind of stylized short form, 4-minute visual radio was mind-blowing at the time. It opened up Americans to British music and new wave. So fashion and culture and style were all just exploding. And I was in New York. So, you know, you literally at MTV, you could meet Andy Warhol. And he was aware of what you were doing. Or Nam June Paik or these video artists who... So the line between what they were doing and what you were doing as a 24-year-old kid experimenting in the edit room was very, the lines were blurred. Again, I just was trying. I wasn't taught in design or art or film. I just was saying, what does that button do? I knew nothing about collage. I didn't even know what I was making. So my boss said, oh, you're making a collage. I said, what is a collage? I had no idea of art history.
Yes. Well, I was going to say, you've called yourself an untrained interpretive artist. That's what you mean by it, is basically that you just came to it with a natural sense of what you wanted to do.
I knew I liked music. I was very passionate about music. I think I was connected emotionally I was not afraid of words and communicating and using text and words. And I think that that's why I was drawn to editing, because you didn't have to. You could use other people's images and sift through it and make it your own. Mm. And you didn't have to know anything about shooting or photography or directing at the time.
Right. You have a BA in rhetoric, which is not the standard choice of degree in modern times. I'm wondering what attracted you to study this, and also how that affected your use of words in your work.
Well, at the University of Virginia, where I went to Virginia on a lacrosse scholarship. I was there, kind of followed my brother, and I realized when I was there, I was like, I might have picked the wrong school. If I was very interested in music and media and journalism, it was a very traditional school. So they had a rhetoric and mass communications department. No real media classes, no TV and film. And I considered transferring it, but I was having such a good time there and DJing and playing lacrosse and writing record reviews that I felt, there'll be plenty of time to get specialized later. So I went for the social education, if you will.
Right, yeah. Did you grow up in a creative environment in your family?
No. I mean, my father owned a restaurant and was an ex-football player. And it wasn't until years later that he got Alzheimer's that I realized he had a gift for painting. That he started to paint after he was afflicted with dementia. Which is interesting. My mother was very verbal, very social. I think she dabbled in painting a little bit. They were both very musical. They loved music. Uh-huh. So we always had a lot of music playing around when I was young. I didn't really go to movies that much, or I don't think I stepped foot in a museum until I got to college.
So is it really college that opened up your world as far as art was concerned?
No, it was going to New York in 1983 for the summer as an intern. That was the game. That was the mind blower. It was New York City and New York City, walking culture. That was the mind blower.
Yeah.
On all levels. All levels of life.
I can imagine, yes. Wow. I wanted to ask you, going back to the music videos, your music video for the song Beautiful Girl by INXS was nominated for a Grammy, and it's a sort of visual essay about the pressure on women to be defined as beautiful based on narrow cultural standards. And I was thinking when I watched it that I'm sure a lot of directors, given that track, might have just gone for sort of arty images of scantily clad women, or maybe a romantic narrative. What inspired you to take the approach that you did, which sort of elevates the video into an art piece rather than just a pop visual?
Well, at the time, I was living with a young woman who had suffered from and was battling dysmorphia, body image issues.
Yeah.
And so I knew personally the struggles and what she had gone through. And when I heard the song, I kind of took the lyrics apart and said, these girls are facing all these pressures from outside, and it's kind of fragmenting them. And it's making them schizophrenic on a certain level. So I decided to shoot the male image of the band with these strips. So I said, well, let's disembody and fragment the male point of view and narration of it. And then let's present the quote-unquote real girls, and my girlfriend at the time, it was one of them. Her and a cast of others, portraits of them with little visuals that were little visual commentaries. And I worked, the production designer was an artist, was a fine artist named Amy Morgana, who had made these very small little tableaus. She was an artist and sculptor. So she helped me, and we collaborated on the ideas. It was very interesting. Like, there's a couple of ideas that are direct appropriations of pop, of advertising images. Like the girl with the braces and celery in her mouth was a direct appropriation of an image of a model with celery, but I put it into a young 15-year-old girl with braces. And I think there was another one where a girl was behind like a prison of the tape measure. And it was funny. So I was like, oh, no, we can't use that image. That's stealing. And she said, no, it's appropriation. Right? So this was, and we had done all these pieces with Buzz about appropriation and sampling and what's inspiration and what's putting your own spin on it. And I said, I don't know, that's a little close to the bone, but I forget what spin we put on it to make it our own.
But it's true. I mean, all art is reductive in some way, isn't it?
You know, I always, I'm inspired all the time by images. I keep a file of images, usually pulled from the New York Times. They're some of the most, you know, amazing photographs of the world, and I'll find myself pulling them out of a paper. I've got to keep a big file of stuff that just inspires me. It reminds me of humanity, and often it has to do with suffering, and there's a little window into the world.
And I think it's interesting with music, with image. I mean, like in that video where you, your images were, you know, dealing with a different subject to perhaps the content of the original lyric. It's the same thing, I think, with soundtracks, with films. You have songs which perhaps originally were conceived with a different sort of impetus, and then you put them with the image of the film, and they have a different meaning. And that's something that you've pursued through a lot of different aspects of your work, isn't it? Is bringing these different things together, which increases the meaning or enhances the meaning.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes if it's a music video, sometimes I always look at lyrics first. A lot of directors don't. A lot of filmmakers don't know how to write a treatment. Some are, the band would say, I don't, we wrote the lyrics, you make up your own mind, you decide, you interpret it yourself. Same way when we did a, you know, United States of Poetry, I worked with 75 poets. And whether it's a Nobel Prize winner, Derek Walcott, who just recently passed away, to an unknown New Yorkan poet, to a housewife in Kentucky, or a displaced Arab American woman in San Antonio, Naomi Shahid Nye. Like, each poet I would talk to on the phone and say, okay, my job, what I want to do is bring your poetry to life in this new medium. The only rule I had was, I don't want to film you sitting there reading your poetry. We're not using the form. This isn't a filmed poetry reading. We were trying to bring the words to life. And some were very engaged, and some were like, why would you do that? And each one was different. And it transcended gender or age. You know, I remember Czeslaw Milos. I was outside of Berkeley. Nobel Prize, I mean, just famous, right?
Like, yeah.
Incredible. And I sat with him, and I said, I imagine your words coming out of a small speaker at a drive-in theater. And I widen out, and I see all these cars with people, and they're all listening to your poem. And you're inside, you see glimpses into the people's lives as they're listening, and a tear here, and a sense of whatever the interpretation was. And at the end, We cut to a wide shot, and the last shot is just a portrait of you looking down at all the cars.
Mm.
He goes, that is a terrible idea. He was like, why would you do that? Why don't you just film me? Now, at the time, he was probably close to, like, late 70s.
Right.
I'll never forget this. In his Polish accent, it is a terrible idea. And I was like, wow, I thought it was pretty awesome. I thought, wow, because I was just interpreting the words. That's all.
Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to my special guest from the arts this week, award-winning director, writer and producer Mark Pellington. We're going to go to a short break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
Like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
No white horses to play the game. About you in the rain. Did I or didn't I say it's forever? Well, I know I said it, baby, just go nowhere.
It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Bookshop Santa Cruz is celebrating 50 years of independent bookselling in the community that we love. Visit Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown and join in the festivities as we celebrate our customers and the books that make it all possible. Bookshop Santa Cruz, celebrating an amazing 50 years in downtown Santa Cruz.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copeland, and my special guest from the arts this week, award-winning director, producer and writer, Mark Pellington. So, Mark, you were up in San Jose recently at the world premiere of your latest feature film, The Last Word, starring Shirley MacLaine and Amanda Seyfried. I was wondering if you could tell us what attracted you to this project, this story.
The Last Word is a dramatic comedy about a woman played by Shirley MacLaine who's a control freak. And she decides the last thing she's going to try and control is her obituary. So it sets us off onto a very fable-like tale, almost a comic fantasy about her journey to... to fulfill the obligations of what she determines to be a perfect obituary, and in the process forges a friendship and a kind of a life-altering mentorship of a young writer named played by Amanda Seyfried. And I was engaged by the themes of mortality and memory and identity. And I've always been interested in those kind of characters. The opportunity to work with somebody like Shirley, the opportunity to work with actors in this, in a dramatic, in this tone, mixing the tone of drama and comedy is very difficult. And
yeah,
I wanted to keep working on that to see if I like it or whether I could do it.
Yes.
And to simply just tell this story about these women all searching for, they're really searching for a family, to complete a family. They all have a hole in their life. And that was kind of why I decided to do it, or what drew me to it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I was fortunate to go to the premiere and really enjoyed it. And it wasn't until the film was almost over that I realized that nearly the whole film is just women on screen. And it's not about that necessarily, but it just was interesting to sort of think, wow, this whole film went through with like three generations almost of women. And it was so compelling, but you don't see that very often.
Yeah, you don't, and I don't think I don't, you know, it was written by a man and directed by a man, and but like both of us are, we had strong relationships with our mothers, Stuart Fink, the writer, and I, deeply passionate. We have both have daughters. We both, I just think we're both guys who are in touch with that and didn't even really think about it. He just wrote the character, and I feel like I've done films that have had strong female roles. I've worked with lots of female artists and poets, and in television worked with very strong creative showrunners who are females. So I feel like I've got a good balance, if you will,
yeah,
of masculine and feminine energy in my life and in my soul. I a lot of music videos that are very, about the, like that In Excess piece, and other ones that are really, I can kind of write from I can flip genders when I write. A couple of very dark music videos I made, I actually just wrote from a young female point of view. Because I don't know why I could relate more to a woman that I said in this culture, a woman was automatically kind of in a culture of victimization, more so than a man. And I was looking for, little subconscious pieces where the protagonist was trying to regain power, and powerlessness. Women are given less power in our culture than men. So in writing some of these things, I found myself just writing it as a 28-year-old woman. Maybe I should write it as a man to actually, and it would become very personal for me.
Yeah.
These are more in like music videos, more subconscious. These are more in the abstract, some pieces where I can kind of let imagery sift out. And I'm not absolutely certain what it means until I'm actually editing it.
Yeah. I'm very interested in how art can help people process events, difficult events, whether they're events they've experienced themselves or maybe events they've witnessed. And I know a lot of your work seems to go enable some of this processing. I would say you have this piece Honesty, which is an art piece you've created, a short film based on the essay by David White, which can be viewed on YouTube. And it's a moving meditative work which focuses on close-ups of individuals expressing sadness and grief. And I was just wondering what inspired you to create this unusual piece, which, I mean, I would say would be a piece of work that people could really get into and access perhaps some feelings of their own they might not have before.
Well, I, I'd say most, I'd say almost every music video I've done in my career, certainly since 1992, when I did Pearl Jam's Jeremy, that was the first personal video I made where the imagery and expressions came from a subconscious personal place. Mm. And over the years, to varying degrees, I hear a song and I kind of just start to feel and see stuff. And I write it down and I put it out, and that usually is some sort of cathartic personal expression or interpretation of the song. Whether it's I'm Afraid of Flying in 1996, a band called Catherine Wheel. I want to do a video about the last 5 minutes of people's lives before a plane crashes. Huh. And literally, the video cured my fear of flying by showing 15 people's horrific, fear-filled faces right before a plane crashes.
Right.
I'd say they were all fairly interpretive and personal. And in 2004, my wife passed away, and certainly every video since then is some degree of therapy.
Mm.
Some very explicit, like Keane's Everybody's Changing, which has me and my daughter and members of my support group, which is a very specific documentary visual essay about grief recovery. Mm. The Foo Fighters' Best of You is a very, very subconscious, a personal exploration where I know what all the images and what the meaning of them all is, but it's the collision and the juxtaposition of them that takes on a different feeling. And even the band, don't really know what the videos are about. They just have a trust that the that it'll feel right.
Mm.
So over the years, they change, and something like Moby was, again, a very personal video for me. And so by having gone through grief recovery and healing, and when I heard David White's, just the words themselves, they really inspired me to dig deeper in my own. And I said, I've got to do something with this piece.
Mm.
And I imagined I would shoot other imagery. And I said, well, let's just start with the human face. I love the human face. And I asked people, I said, show up at a studio. The payment is catharsis. You're not going to get paid. You'll be paid to feel and express your feelings on camera.
Were they actors?
They were real people and actors. They just opened, my casting director put out an open call.
Mm.
So they were just, they were, some of them were actors, but none of them were acting.
Right.
You know, so maybe they were more in touch with their ability to express feelings.
Mm.
And I said, just bring a picture of somebody that you lost. And so I would be in the room, and the music and that voice track would be on a loop. It just kept looping over and over again. People would come in four in a row. They would stand there, and I would have them just, I would motion for them to come forward. They would come right towards the camera. I would take the photo and sometimes put it underneath the camera for them to look at or to the side. I would take it away because I only wanted the photo to be the trigger.
Mm.
And as I started doing it, I realized that they didn't need the photo to open up. They all wanted to, they all had it in them. And sometimes they just couldn't wait to cry. Other times they couldn't feel anything. You could just tell that they, to varying degrees, they were in touch with the, because the words, what the words were saying, the words were kind of very much soothing yet challenging you to ask yourself, what is honesty?
Mm.
You know, what true honesty requires a you have to reach to a point of complete powerlessness and humility. And so depending on the age of the subject, 23 years old or 75 years old, each person was bringing their own life story and life feelings to their, and they were all hearing it for the first time.
Right.
So as you hear the piece and you listen to the music, you're kind of in this protective womb of feeling. You're right next to me. I'm seeing them. I could slightly move the camera. I could hold their hand. I could kind of guide them. I could let them. So it's almost like holding their hand sometimes and feeling them go through it. And then I'd feel them like release, and I would sometimes release their hand. Like they were just, everybody did something different.
Yeah.
And I shot myself. And I realized, so I went and I thought I was going to make another piece about my own grief and my relationship to my wife. Yet I realized when I was editing it, I didn't use any of the pictures of people because I realized that's what it was. That's not what it was about. The piece says, honesty is reached through the doorway of grief and loss. You go through it. You go through the tear of grief in order to begin to even sense what real honesty is. And that was my, so that's what was drawing me towards that piece and David's work in general, which I want to do more of. I want to do a whole film with his words, and we've talked about it, like what it would be. And, you know, because his words are just unbelievably human and healing.
Yeah.
And their philosophy, their poetry, their, Him performing live is kind of like a, it's like a rock show meets a sermon meets a campfire, just storyteller. But all the words are incredibly, I mean, all of his words are incredibly just accessible and human and inspiring.
Yeah. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to my special guest from the arts this week, Mark Pellington, award-winning director, writer, and producer. We're going to go to a short break now, but we'll be back with more conversation after these messages.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel, and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Coplin, and my special guest from the arts this week, Mark Pellington, award-winning director, writer, and producer. And before the break, we were talking about Mark's short film, Honesty, based on an essay by David White. It's an incredibly moving piece of work that you can see on YouTube. And David White, on his website, says, "All poems are an emblem of courage and the attempt to say the unsayable, but only a few are able to speak to something universal yet personal and distinct at the same time." And I would say this statement is true of all art. And I'm wondering, Mark, what your thoughts are as far as film is concerned on the possibilities of creating work that is unique yet universal in how it touches us. Do you think that it's possible to find something that's very unique that can reach that many people in terms of film?
Yeah, I think it's a different narrative plot-driven film is different than, let's say, an immersive. Like, Honesty is a very deep, poetic, kind of very musical piece. And again, of 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I'd be curious, like, what 90 minutes. I've made, like...
Right.
I've made 50-minute music-driven art. I made a film called Lone for a woman named Chelsea Wolfe that's very kind of artistic and subconscious and immersive and beautiful. I think that audiences, now some audiences are different. If you go into a gallery and look at a painting or a sculpture or a photograph, if one asks themselves how long they explore that experience with that image or set of images, and again, that's often very tactile, or you're close to it, you control how close you are to it. I think the film experience in a movie theater is a different one. And over the course of 90 minutes, I've been to very, very long Bill Viola, art film experiences, which are very different. I think that's why plot, story, and character are the engines which drive most narrative films that are in movie theaters.
So you would differentiate between art films and sort of story narrative films.
Yeah, well, I think it's the immersion and the investment in characters' lives that makes it universal and human. So if you're watching Moonlight or Under the Skin or Youth or Manchester by the Sea or even Arrival, let's say five of my favorite films where the immersion into the story, some are more plot driven than the others, all kind of have characters going through experiences where the tone and the hand guiding you through it is very specific.
Yes. Yeah.
But those were movies that I left changed, where I left the theater feeling I had an artistic experience or a relationship similar to maybe looking at the paintings in Florence or a concert, a musical concert. A poetry reading.
Yeah. You said to me...
Where you felt changed. Where you felt changed, less alone, inspired, more connected, transported, perhaps.
You said to me in a previous conversation we had that great art makes one feel less alone. Do you think that that is something that is a thread that's through, more contemplative art pieces and also, longer, more commercial narrative pieces? Or not necessarily.
It's different. It's different for everyone. I think that
commercial,
the intentions of a commercial narrative film are different than an art piece. Like, I'm making a new film now called Nostalgia, which is a drama. It's 2 hours long. It's very slow. It's very meditative. There's no songs. There's music in it. But it's more akin to... it's definitely an art film.
Uh-huh.
And not that audiences can't relate to it, but it's, you know, the inspiration was to make a film like Amour. You know, quieter, character-driven, story, you know, less plot, but characters in life situations where the theme of loss and memorabilia and family and value of objects was the operative engine.
Right.
And the tone and the pace of it is slower, and it's kind of, it's patient, and there's a lot of space in it that allows you to kind of experience it differently. It's not hurried.
Right.
I'm not putting like, oh, I've got to pace it up because the audience will get bored.
Mm.
None of that.
Yeah. Yeah. You created a 5-part series for PBS. We talked about earlier the United States of Poetry, which takes the viewer on this cross-country journey through end-of-the-century America with 72 poets and spoken word artists. And it's a sort of kaleidoscopic portrait of America. Now, the whole point of PBS is to allow programming to be made that may not be deemed commercially viable necessarily. And in America, it almost seems sacrilegious to contemplate making something that won't necessarily make money. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how money defines success in the US in general, and specifically in the arts, because, you know, the kind of projects, some of the projects we've been talking about, if, you know, they're going to be defined in terms of making a lot of money, then that's a different thing to the success of creating a compelling piece of art that really affects people.
Well, the United States of Poetry was made, interestingly enough, 20 years ago, and I doubt, especially with the horrible Trump budget cuts, you know, which might be eliminating the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is just horrific. You know, that 20 years ago, the arts on television and the arts were more vital. And I think there was less of a culture that was all about the weekend box office and the quantitative, you know, the measure of success.
Yeah.
Oh, a movie is thumbs up or thumbs down, or how many, what was the number on Rotten Tomatoes? Everything is culturally has to be kind of quantified.
Yes.
And so it becomes, criticism has changed, audiences have changed, fragmentation has increased. So in some ways that's created a great opportunity in democratization, where cameras are cheaper, anybody can make anything at any point and put it out in the world. Anything. Go shoot even Facebook Live, or Everybody can put out anything. I could do live streaming poetry right now.
Yeah.
And so that's great. That's great on a level. So therefore, there needs to be people such as yourself, or gatekeepers or curators, really, to this. It's how people find out about it, how people organize the arts and poetry and music to, you know, to join with politics and social messaging to say, wait, this is what we care about. This is why we care about it. This is the world we want to live in, and we want our music and our art to reflect our values and our interests and our, you know, and everything. So specialized in sub-genres of fragments that it's hard for you not to find your tribe.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
So in a way, unifying the universality of that is harder to find. Look at TV ratings decline because there's nothing unifying. You know, it takes it takes tragedy. It takes Newtown or Orlando to unify us.
Yeah.
You know, grief. Grief is the collective grief is the one unifying TV show, unfortunately, that we all share.
Yes.
I remember I wanted to do a music video hot, right on the heels of Orlando for Green Day. And it was going to be, I was like, man, I have a really brutal, vicious piece inside of me. And they just didn't want to make a political statement. They didn't want to make any sort of statement about it. So, well, God, if you guys don't want to make a statement, you know, then what are you doing?
Well, I think in a way, in order to appeal to the masses, everything has had to be simplified. It has to be black or white. The shades of gray are being lost, you know, in this drive to try and just create something that's easily consumed to everybody's loss, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, there's so much media, there's so much music and art and articles and essays, and there's so much information, and it can swallow you. You could get lost in the rabbit hole of.
Yeah. We've actually got to the end of the show almost. So I just wanted to ask you really quickly if there is an overarching theme you're trying to communicate through your work, or is every project different for you? And in a minute or less, please, Mark.
I don't have any intentional message. I think one could look back and notice things and say, oh, you're interested in this or that, or a story of a man trying to find his way in a confusing world or searching for home. But I change. I think I can't make the work. I could never go make the same thing again, because life just changes and evolves. And, you know, like right now, I either want to do a dark thriller or a love story. You know, because I've never really done a love story. And I kind of want to make something after doing a comedy drama. That's movies.
Yes.
And music videos, I hear different songs, and it either hits you or it doesn't.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
I have no master plan.
Okay. Well, if listeners want to go to your website, markpellington.com, there is a whole array of all your different areas of creativity, which is quite amazing, really, Mark. So I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing some of that with us. It's really just very inspiring.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
You know, it's there to share with people and share my process, and I hope that for another 25 years, I can continue to just keep creating and having people feel less alone in the world.
Well, I hope you have another 50 years of doing that. And thank you so much again.
All right. Thank you, Ruth.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance. Thank you for joining me. And I look forward to being with you again next time.